Welcome to TunnelVision. I'd love to thank our fantastic sponsor, Squarespace, which is a great platform for making a website so easily you won't even believe it, and Eventualism, the perfect site for when you want to learn how to get everything done eventually.
It's Heather Gold, and we're live. It's TunnelVision TV coming to you live from Philadelphia. We're here at Supernova, and more specifically, we're here in TunnelVision regular Andrew Hazlett, and not just with Andrew Hazlett, but we're in his hotel room, and not just any hotel room, but a special quarters hotel room that you're sort of a, it's like kind of like you're a sailor, but you belong to a special fraternity of businessmen, sailors, and you meet at docks in various towns, and they're full of strange wallpaper and carpets, and this little place you go to eat grub together, and then you come back to the hole to get something done. And luckily for us, Andrew has a microphone, an H2Zoom mic that can let all of us talk in the same mic. So therefore, you're going to hear all of us through the same mic tonight. So I'm here, we're all in Philadelphia, also in person in the same room, which is a little odd for us. So I'm here also. Deb Schultz is here.
Hi, folks. I'm sitting on the floor underneath the mic.
Kevin Marsh will not be with us unless he gets it together and starts tweeting. Kevin, we would love to have you. If you can get typed in, that would be awesome. But we don't know where you are because
he's tweeting from somewhere, but that's a day ago.
No, it posted 12 minutes ago.
Okay. You can't hide from the internet.
You can't hide, Kevin. You can't pretend you just have things going on and then tweet answers to other people because you know. Anyway, and our special, super special guest tonight is Ted Reingold, founder of Dogster and all those tech bon vivants. Welcome, Ted Reingold.
I love bon vivants.
Yay!
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. My whole goal.
You've made it now.
I really actually will sleep well tonight.
Well, you're like with the David Letterman of the internet. And Andrew Hazlett, who you guys have seen in the chat room for lo these many weeks, you can hear his voice. Andrew, can you share your salutations with everyone?
I'm just delighted to be here and looking for the applause sign that tells me when to clap.
Now!
Huzzah! Huzzah! Oh yay! Oh yay! Welcome! Enter! Oh, no, I'm going to feel like I'm in court. Because I did my show last night, you guys. By the way, Law Project kicked some ass. I kicked a lot of ass last night.
Did the law win?
No, I won. Okay. I fought the law and I won. Along with everybody else in my interactive show, I had a great beta. So I'll let you guys know as it keeps developing. It was a lot of fun. So, John, we did an unconference session today at Supernova, which you can read more about. Everyone's tweeting it at SN10 with a little hashtag. And we did a session on the human side of tech, from conscious to brain to tumbling, and we did some tumbling in the room. And one of the things that Ted brought up, well, the first thing we usually do, Ted, is try to check if there's issues in the week. The big issue we'll get to, it will be ambient sociality, and we'll get to that in a little bit, which is something that he wants to talk about. Oh, wow, you're recording videos.
No, I'm trying to take a photo, but keep talking.
So did anything happen this week, you guys? Oh, Zoom for you now. Awesome. Hey, Myers. So what about, did we have any big, oh yeah, we did have a big moment, kind of. Facebook decided to add questions to Facebook. Did anything else really?
Oh, I missed that.
Break? Yeah, because there aren't enough features in Facebook. They thought you'd like something else to look at in the interface. It was really so empty. So, yeah, subtle social media humor. Which actually came up in Anil Dash's presentation with Gina. Anil's running Expert Lab, which is an attempt to bring crowdsourcing to government of experts kind of trying to address policy questions. So they're going to try to integrate with Facebook through the questions feature when they get it kind of together. You know, Facebook thought after they built an advertising machine, they could, you know, make community that really served people. Well, we'll see. I don't know what you think, Ted. Are they going to succeed? I mean, I feel like we're stuck with them, but
we're so stuck with them. I don't think they're going to get the community around it. I think they've lost a lot of community. The only reason people use it is because all their friends are posting there. Quora, however, I used to think was just going to be a conversation place for VCs and entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
But now if their goal really is to facilitate those conversations for anyone about any topic, I think they will do a really good job of it.
Right.
And it's more paragraph-based.
Nephi does that too, Metafilter.
Yeah.
We had Justin on the show a few weeks ago.
Other Quora, it kind of seems to be more like a academically oriented, like thorough, long answers, and less like, oh, try starting your car in the garage before you go out.
Right.
What less people, tips and more real, like,
when
creative.
People start posting questions like, looking at Car Talk, because any place that answers questions and eventually comes down to interpersonal human issues, which is what rules all of our lives, right? Like, yeah, it's about the car, but it's really about my wife and I having this fight.
Right.
And that's, of course, the prime and center of the people before data principle that we call, that we're into and that's humbling, right? That we're doing stuff for each other. And if we remember that, it helps make stuff better. So I feel like everyone eventually goes there, to be honest with us. And that's always much more interesting, isn't it? To hear, you know, how to fight, how do we make it work, or my dad hates me, or, I mean, isn't that what's driving most people, that kind of stuff?
Well, they might need an answer about how to.
It might be a practical question, like, my battery is dead.
Yeah, but that's something we need to answer with the internet. Like, you need another person to do it, because if you just search, now that we have so much stuff in the web, you don't need a person to answer that anymore. You just Google search the answer to that so quickly.
What if you get conflicting answers? Or you don't get the exact same answer?
Well, that's what the web is so good for, because you get 7 or 8 answers, and by the end you get the gist of what the best answers were instead of the exact right one.
But you don't, like, so for example, okay, here's a personal question, which I tried to take to Twitter. Many people have been very open about it. I had a blighted ovum a couple months ago, and I had to have an induced miscarriage, otherwise known as an abortion. But not because, you know, I didn't want the developing at that time embryo. It was not going to develop. It had stopped in 5 weeks, and that was all that was going to happen. So I had 2 options. I could have DNC, or I could use this drug called Cytotec, and I wanted to know what people's experiences, because even though I could read lots of stories about experiences online, I wasn't sure if they were really skewed to only people with bad experiences posting about them. And I wondered if someone knew that I knew, but no one wanted to talk about it publicly. Or I had a whole experience trying to be public about miscarriage and people freaking out that I was willing to talk about that publicly. I got a lot of response like, well, you know, Jeff Jarvis's penis. He tweets about his prostate cancer. It'll be a lot of his next book. It'll be about his penis. Or Howard Rheingold's ass. He talked about his issues online. And I was like, but your womb is more sacred, someone has said.
Did someone say that?
In a way of saying, I think this is why you're getting kind of slack or a different kind of response. And I had a really long, interesting thread on Facebook that I can't search or link to because Facebook doesn't think that's important. So,
all about the now.
Yeah, forget everything you ever did talk about. So anyways, there I would like people to tell me, you know, what's your experience? I was willing to go offline. I don't know. I mean, I wanted it to be pretty, not just specific to my situation. I want to know how they felt about it. And one of their symptoms, but also want to know, you know, all the emotional stuff and just tweet, you know, I don't know. Where would I go to get that?
Health website forum for people with that issue.
I looked at forums but they weren't through someone I knew. The thing about once you get known in the community, there's a different sense of trust because you have a different human context around who's telling you this stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Because you have followers on Twitter. It's not just your friends.
Right. But you still get to know them when you respond to each other.
Good point.
Like, I know Andrew because he's been in the chat room. And now we're, you know, physically touching each other.
He's real. Here's what would be really great if you could do off of Twitter, and maybe this app exists already. My response to Heather is, you are much more comfortable with sharing those kinds of things publicly. I bet there were people who wanted to share their responses, and you might have gotten some private.
I asked. I gave out an email address for private responses.
And did you get any?
You know how I got them? I got them in my inbox and Facebook from a few, and I got them in person. You know what? Mostly from men. When next time there was a couple of events, internet events, because I was talking about it, they'd all come up to me and be like, my girlfriend just had my wife last year. I mean, I got more responses from guys who obviously know my stream or know me, and some of them were way more upset about the whole thing than I was. But in part, I have to say, it was very big part of how I emotionally processed the experience. And I think one of the reasons I got over like the sadness factor was because of that. I mean, I think it's a really great thing to experience whatever emotion you're having, fully feel it, and then it lets you move faster. And the more open you are, the less shame you're thinking, for me. So it helped me a lot to be public about it.
And you don't feel a backlash. You don't get emotionally hurt by someone abusing that information and saying something unpleasant about you or hearing later.
I'm a comedian, so that's part of my practice. And I've done I've done a lot of stuff in the performance art tradition where you intentionally make yourself very publicly vulnerable and kind of raw. So a lot of the talks I do about authenticity comes from a creative tradition of using that quite consciously, and I use it in my solo shows too. So I know that's part of the territory, and I'm someone who's probably uniquely suited in a lot of ways, partially because I got so much flack so early in life, I got kind of inoculated. And then I learned through all this kind of performance to not take it, to not have it, no, it's not about me. And in a way, the more you're open with it, the more you kind of open the larger conversation, because when you don't react to those things, I'm so offended way, people go, oh, I can say what I want to, as opposed to just what you think you want to hear.
I think also the really interesting part about that, and I don't know how much of this is who follows you on the stream or who doesn't, but what's really interesting is that you opened a door and made something that was scary to talk about for guys who've gone through this with other people. Like, they were the ones who came over to you, which is, to me, really interesting. That's a really interesting sociodynamic point in and of itself. So it's the, thanks for helping me to understand what my girlfriend or wife or whatever might have been going through. So it was you, for that group, you opened a real door and a way for them to talk about it, which is where for some women or other women, it may still be too difficult, or they don't want
women to talk to me, too, in different contexts that I was coming into. And the thing that was amazing to me, and I still have to write this up as a post, it's so common. Every third woman has had a miscarriage, practically. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, if it's this common, it is a little interesting that there isn't as much writing about it this way, because you're all having this private experience. And part of what I was physically going through it that was so difficult was I kept thinking about women of past generations who went through it alone. My mom miscarried, and she was alone.
Yep.
And it's a very hard emotional, very, very intense emotional experience. And I just have such deep respect for so many women in the world. And I just think there's so much resilience and strength in some of these women that guys who think they're all tough because they go to war and stuff don't even know the half of what so many women have been through, very often alone. Very often in between what's going through your body and who else you're responding. I mean, women who are already mothers who have to take care of their children while they're going through this, it's incredible.
And there are a lot of families that never talked about it ever again.
Right.
The baby didn't come, and never again for years and years and years, never discussed. So the fact that you're talking about it publicly on a place or Twitter where a big problem with Twitter I have is that you hear very little bad news. Sometimes people vent, oh, this guy was a jerk in line at the airport. But it's mostly a place where people say good things that are happening about them, and then they go quietly lick their wounds. And it creates this kind of false psychology that things are better than they are because you just don't hear.
And it teaches people to artificially pimp themselves in a kind of fake, pushy way that makes it really like it's like everyone's trying to sell you a gold watch walking down the street.
Yeah.
I found again from doing the kind of performance that I do that if you tell these intentionally revealing stories, everybody in the world will come up to you, sometimes in the show if you make space for it, and often after, and tell you something. This is why I try to talk about vulnerability so much and stuff that I'm doing, but I learned not to name the talks vulnerability because the business world is so freaked out about it. But the truth is that how trust is partially created. It's not created through false bravado or even real bravado. I mean, there's a certain amount I feel secure with you if you're really brave, but the way you know that there was a real challenge, there was a real owning of something difficult. You can't do that by saying everything always went well and I figured it all out. Because even, you know, a conference like FailCon is exciting to people because they're going to hear mistakes. See, we all make them. Yeah, and also for how you unshame. I know from coming out, you know, once you do that,
I know I read some interesting things here from Myers and Xenophrenia. Myers is saying, can you imagine if Yelp covered medical procedures? It's kind of a funny idea, but there is a lot of stuff online. I think medical usage is one of the main uses of the web.
It's actually, guys, not such a funny idea. I know two startups that are creating, I guess, for want of a better term, health 2.0 kinds of sites. So if you think about it, when something is wrong, you're diagnosed with something, there are two places that you go, either to your social network online or your social network offline.
Or your doctor.
Obviously, your doctor, but then also,
I've heard everyone goes to the WebMD. They don't tell anyone.
Right. So there's two things. That's what I'm saying. People either go to WebMD or they ask, if it's a really, private thing or not, or they ask their friends, I have allergies. What do you take? So there's a couple of startups now that are working on this construct of how do you identify and get the information from people that you know, but also how do you research diagnoses along the way? So WebMD and those places are usually like very binary. They're like, these are the protocols for service. But also, how do you prevent this from happening? Or what's the lifestyle of taking care of this? What's the life cycle of taking care of this? And we can do that stuff today online. There's no reason why we can't. We're combining the two. So there is some interesting stuff going on, for sure.
It's still brave of you to do that. Howard was really brave when he did Howard Rangel's bud. Just put it out there and to talk about it and talk that he's having really bad days. And I know for a fact it was very beneficial to him to be able to say, I'm having a really crappy day.
It is really helpful, but I also found it really interesting that you can hear about Jeff Dick or how it's asked, but when I'm going to talk about the fact that, it also made jokes, too, because it's part of how I deal, that people are like, it's a girl, and she's doing girl things.
I thought the response, I haven't followed Jeff's situation, but I thought the response to Howard's butt was pretty muted. I think a lot of people were uncomfortable with it, and I would try and make a point about it and retweet it. No one seemed to want to talk back about it. That may be just me, but
I also think, Heather, that tweeting something out like that is, we're friends, and I didn't respond to you there. So the point is, the one good or bad thing about Twitter and the real-time nature is, if I'm remembering correctly, both Jeff and Howard also wrote long blog posts, and that's
what
the audience gathered.
I will do.
So there's a little bit of, serendipity and just in time, and if you happen to see that, the problem that I always have had with Twitter is that it's great if you happen to be looking at that information at that moment, or you know the right hashtag, but you probably had a lot of people that would have loved to have responded, but you know what? They weren't looking at
this. I got lots of friends who were supportive. Getting back to the original point of this was, so I was trying to answer a question about Quora or other places where you're asking questions about Facebook.
Yeah.
Because I was trying, I only had so much time to decide, which of these procedures am I going to have? And that was where I really wanted to help, was, okay, did you do this one? Mm-hmm. Was it really as painful for you? Because every response I read in the online health forums about the site attacks was that people had terrible, terrible, terrible pain, which I really didn't want. But it was much less expensive than the other procedure. And anyway, so I was just trying to figure out that. And that was where I really wanted, and more a way to be with people where I think there's a way to create, kind of side room spaces, maybe that are tumbled by a person.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes you want to invite 12 people and say, hey, guys, I'm going to be there for this half hour. Do you want to come over here? Because I could use, if you know anyone else who knows about this stuff, then come in here anonymously, they can come in here and know me. But I think there's room for different ways of crowdsourcing and question asking that I don't think, I certainly don't think Facebook is going to be surprised if they can do. Well, I'm not saying just my particular scenario I'm putting out there, but I think there's room for a lot of this because we all have lots of decisions to make, and sometimes you want feedback. Sometimes you have a lot of time to get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
It would be amazing. It would be amazing if you could be connected with people because of that topic that you created, without having to go out and find them. That ambient sociality.
Right.
Where without having to register, without having to make a hashtag, there was some intelligence in the system. And by amazing, I think it would be amazing, and it's very, very sophisticated. But how wonderful would that be if by saying that you found a room full of people who were actually very welcoming to you? a lot of people come to Dogster and Catster after their pet has died.
There you go. I bet a lot of people
who become lifelong members first joined because they lost a pet and they had no one to talk to who they felt like could understand that situation. And then they go right to the dearly missed forum or other places and get this huge group hug from complete strangers who. But they have to find it in the first place. And a lot of them probably went to 8 other sites before they found it because you don't really know what you're looking for. You're so upset and you want some answers, but really you want a hug or really you want someone, you know, to give you advice on should you get another dog yet or not. But it is just such a constant theme in members I talk to. That was how some of the real long-term members found it.
So people are looking to feel understood and feel like there's a place where you can have a feeling. And I think you're right. Twitter is really not easily that space. I try to create that space, by the way. I mean, I think people create them, and that's part of my point about tumbling is when I talk about going first, you help create the tone of the kind of virtual space you're going to set up and say, this is how it's okay to behave here. And that's why I think this idea of personal branding is so antithetical to having public space you can really be your different kinds of parts of yourself in. Because this idea is, I represent dogs all the time. That's my personal brand. I'm Ted Reingold. Well, I mean, how else have you get to be? I mean, the notion of branding is consistency and unilateralness. And it's the same kind of artifice that law is built on. It's very algorithmic. It's an idea that something is always the same. People aren't always the same. So I think the idea that you're branding yourself as a person is kind of funny because, one, I think it's almost impossible to live up to as a human being because it means, you know, you have to constantly be about that thing. I mean, look at artists who get known for a certain kind of music. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in playing exactly that music anymore. It's like, she didn't have colors. She didn't have any fucking injury. I paid $30. She fucking ripped that page, you know? And, like, I don't feel that again. I'm 42 now, whatever. There's no room for you to grow and be a person. So I think having a relationship with somebody is, you know, and then being open about what it's there about. Anyway, I think I try to create, at least in the space that I'm on Twitter, I don't know how successful I am, but where it can be a little bit different and not just be here's me and props to me 24/7. And
well, I think though that Twitter kind of stinks at threaded conversation. It was never kind of it is meant for one-off observations. So in whatever new tools or apps that they build or that gets built around it. You know, I'm trying to, with my design hat on, I'm trying to envision where ambient sociality, what it would look like if you had an automatic thread start with a hashtag somewhere where that group in that moment could have that IRC back channel for that moment in time in an open way, as opposed to, because that does exist now, but your point is that the blocker, you know, is registering, logging in, going to another place. I mean, this is going to sound like a bad metaphor, but it's almost like you have to be careful with that ambient sociality,
yeah,
too, because I want to be in control of, you know, I can see a really, really evil world where if you just type, you know, R or dog died or Pepsi or whatever, and then what pops up is join us talking about that over here. You know, it could be this constant, you know, information superhighway with lots of billboards where you ramp off.
Except it's more.
It could be awesome.
It'll be more like a cult. It'll be like a million virtual Hare Krishnas,
right,
for different corporations saying we really love you. And we can't wait to talk to you and give you a delicious vegetarian,
right,
meal.
Come on in.
All right, but what if there was an agent that was going through your friends' Twitter feeds and many other things and their friends and could point out to you, I think this might be interesting to you.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of noise in there. But boy, if you could get that right, you know, come up more. You said only tip me off 5 times a day. So this whole agent thing was coming with the 5 most interesting things that you might be interested in.
Okay, so I got up off the ground to share that full commercial.
I can't see her, but she moved.
I moved. I was sitting crouched in the corner, and I'm trying to upload the photos of us sitting here. And our bandwidth is low, so they'll be uploaded after the show. But I'm on the advisory board of a startup called My Sixth Sense, which is trying really hard to work on some of this stuff, and they call it digital intuition. And it's coming at it from a different angle than you were talking about, but it's sort of signal to noise. It's all about signal to noise. So my question
is, aggregate knowledge based on this? It's like, if we know this, that about you, we can infer this pattern. I think they apply to purchasing.
They apply to purchasing. Everyone's trying to do this kind of stuff, but what's interesting about the way that they're trying to do it in the constructs that we're talking about around feeds and activity streams and social networks, and not solved yet, these guys are really smart and working really hard on it, what you're talking about is, I'm now smarter about you.
Just talking to Ted Rangel, by the way.
I'm pointing at Ted. So I'm now smarter
Ted's talking about, just so you all know what she's talking about.
I now know that Ted just tweeted he's in the 30th Street Station in Philly. So I'm now smarter about you, my social graph. What I want is to be smarter about us together, which is what you're talking about. I want to know what we share in common and when you can jump in or not to the conversation. So the point is, instead of it being this big open funnel like Facebook is, they're doing some algorithm stuff behind the scenes. But wouldn't it be nice if I could say, I want the top five? I put certain things based on what I act on, though. You can make it proactive, like I say, top five, or you can make the things that I respond to or click on or read or react to the most are the things that I'm inherently more interested in.
Now, isn't Facebook doing that now? It drives me crazy when they only show what they think is the most interesting thing, and you miss, like, photos of a baby being born because people aren't...
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't...
I think you still need the person.
I think, again, it's well, because you click and we can measure that. That means you like it the most. Yeah. That's crock of shit that I only click on the things I like the most.
Crock of shit.
That's just not accurate. That means I clicked on those things at most. That's all you know about it. And the assumptions that you're making don't mean you're delivering anything necessarily better to me. I just think it's so frustrating. It's like, well, we can count that. Therefore, doesn't we assume that means something about you? No, it means it's convenient for you to count those things.
Anthony?
Andrew.
Andrew has it, everyone.
It's happened to me so many times recently that something important happens in someone's life on Facebook, and it gets lost in the shuffle because there aren't enough comments on it or not enough likes.
Exactly.
But who's going to like a major life event?
My dad is proud.
Who's going to write like to that? Who's going to comment directly on that? And so you find out.
Can't you just say the option says this is important and we want this thing flagged and we want people to feel supported and responded to. I mean, but that's a human way of looking at it, not a data stream way of looking. I mean, you can create a data stream, right? I mean, there's no reason you can give another option. It's called another way where something is called out or it's...
But they don't do that.
No.
You can't go through the whole stream in order.
And you can't go back to it because once it goes through this stream, it's dead. Like my miscarriage thing, I went to link to it, like I'm going to make a blog post. There's a very detailed, very long thread that many people got into with me that was quite intimate around this miscarriage issue, and they said, oh, you need to worry about this as a big thing, and you need to respond. Jeff Jarvis wants, but I can't quote any of that stuff because I can't find it on Facebook because it's dead to me now.
Wow.
That is so frustrating.
At least on Twitter, I could search for it, and it has a URL.
For a month.
That's
about it.
You know what they're probably thinking.
Search doesn't go forever.
But there are apps being built that are going to let me search back on Twitter, and there aren't apps being built that will let me search back on Facebook. That I know of. I'd love to know there are some, but that's not that out.
Yeah, there's like Backupify lets you, I found like my first tweet in Backupify.
That's cool.
But Facebook, it's only like stuff that you send, like photographs. It's not status updates and discussions, but yeah, it's, you know, they're probably afraid that people are going to spam, this is an important life event. Because there's different kinds of...
But you can put different things. Look, one of the reasons Metafilter works is they put a speed bump in if you have to pay $5 and you have to do a certain amount of commenting before you can post. You can set things up in a community that's also monitored and tumbled by four people. You know, like, stay in there and make the thing stay like a real community. You could do that in other spaces where you make it intentionally difficult. You have to contribute. You can't just show up and spout off all that kind of stuff. But you'd have to then really design the thing that way, not just, you know, but if you're building a system for advertisers, this is part of the issue of business model creation. And for, I care about it a lot because, of course, my interest is in making shows. And the traditional model of television is to build stuff for advertisers. Well, when you're building stuff the same exact way online and you don't let it have an organic period of building a show, just like you build Twitter or some other web service, you inherently build a system for advertisers that you then try to shove people into and make them want it.
Unless you can get everyone to pay for it, or everyone wants to pay for it. Metafilter, Hot or Not, LiveJournal, we're all country club models. We tried really hard with that with Dogster, and the goal was that at least 50% would come in from users. And it didn't happen, and it's very hard to get there, actually, because there aren't many models. DeviantArt is another good example.
Amazing
community of artists, yeah. You don't have to, but everyone just does because...
It makes it work.
Yeah, they love it.
And does that support the site enough?
Yeah, absolutely. Very well, very well. People also buy art made by other people on the site.
Well, that's probably what I was talking about, my hope of making shows, that if you have a big community,
yes.
You can help mediate transactions between people in a way that supports the existence of this connection. Through the show. I mean, Santa Young America's had some success with it too. And then, not ironically, Metafilter is a major sponsor of them. I mean, it kind of goes around. It's like, do you want a genuine experience or do you want to be, you know, an eyeball, I guess.
How about, here would be a nice tumbling app is you log on, forcing yourself to do that, and anyone else who feels like tumbling at that time is... So when you have half an hour, you're like, oh, maybe somebody at home. I don't know. You just log in and do it, and you could possibly be shown things that it might think are of interest to you. So instead of getting that email when you're at work, hey, there's something interesting going on over here. No, it's only when you want it, when you're in your headspace of wanting to share and meet.
It's your mental free time where people are like, hey, this is cool stuff you should be checking out.
That I like.
And
I
then
like
you could meet them, too, the other people were in there then, or have someone do an introduction when you say, you guys don't know each other, because you're assuming everyone there is in a moment where they want to be social. Hopefully they have a drink in their hand or whatever makes them feel relaxed.
Right. Or virtually. I mean, I've been wanting ways to send people virtual snacks or cookies or drinks or ways of saying, acknowledging each other, you know?
Yeah.
So how are we doing here?
I'm just responding to how Meyer found Dogster. Head nodding.
Awesome rescue people on Dogster.
Rescue people are awesome.
I think I may have been running around with some of the mic stuff, but can you say a little bit more about Dogster? I mean, as a former dog owner, that's like formative part of my youth. That's, I'll always look back on that. The family allergies. I don't know if we'll ever own a dog again, but it's. Are you allowing people to create profiles around their pets? Is that what this is?
It started as a whim that there was nowhere to see real people's pets on the internet, and I thought maybe it could be maybe about $1,000 a month in revenue. So I made a place where people could make web pages for their dogs. And
I think it'd be like the most popular thing on the internet.
Well, you know, the internet is at the time I was really fascinated with Friend of a Friend. Now it's called Viral. Right. But at the time, Friend of a Friend could only go so far. And
AKA school.
So I just didn't think it would ever get beyond 10,000 people because there's a lot of noise on the internet. But it really resonated with even hardcore geeks. Oh, I'm going to make a webpage for my dog. I thought they'd make fun of it. So there are now over 1 million profiles of dogs and cats on the site. A number of people just want to make a webpage for their dog, maybe connect with a couple friends or cat. But then that's just a URL they have where they can send to people. A lot of other people are so thrilled that they can meet other people who care about Bichons like they do, or care about rescue, or care about organic homemade dog food recipes, or Maine Coons, and really want to talk, and it's their hub of sociality. It's just grown from there. There's just so many people. It's been a blast.
Did you ever hear the This American Life story about the guy who wanted to make the cable channel Puppies, Puppies, Puppies?
Yes, I have heard about it.
In a way, you have a successful version of Puppies, Puppies, Puppies.
And well, after I made the site, I really wanted to do the puppy show. I just wanted to do a half-hour show of puppies.
Which is this guy wanted 24-hour cable channel, just puppies playing. That's it.
I think it would go. I think it would be really popular in Japan. I think it would be great on airplanes when you're on the 14-hour flight. Let's just show puppies for half an hour. introduce him, show the puppy the puppy has a toy. We're getting a little off topic here, but I totally agree with him.
I want a show of just women like my aunt commenting Mystery Science Theater 3000 style on other people's wedding videos. I want to do that.
Wow.
How great would that be? Like women just going, no,
wow.
It'd be better, one step better than reality shows, because we just want to see real weddings, not fake reality show weddings, and like what we think of them. Anyway.
Let's shine her up.
It's like one major life event that was posted on Facebook that I totally missed.
Right.
One of my friend's beloved pet, Basenji, got his a bunch of his teeth removed. And that's a big deal for a dog and a big deal for the person who cares about it. But, you know, nobody commented on that. I found out after the fact, so late that it was kind of, I was embarrassed to mention it to my friend. Yeah, so it's like, that's my time.
Right, and also in the world of, you know, you're only supposed to say good things about your life. You're only supposed to, you know, brand yourself and let everyone know how great you are. It might make it harder to. It depends. I mean, everyone doesn't treat the web that way. But
now, before the web, it would have happened. You probably wouldn't have sent a letter to all your friends about what happened.
You would have told the someone.
But you would have told. You would have told people when you talked to them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't have had a chance to tell. You know, your friend from college or other people who do still care about you.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we're really talking about life events via social networking tonight. It also surprises me. I mean, I have a good friend from college that we don't keep in touch as much as we used to, and he sent out an email but also put up on Facebook, sadly, that his brother just passed away this week from a battle with cancer, which I knew he'd been sick. I didn't know he'd been that sick. So, to me, as much as I sort of kind of rag on that these tools aren't good enough about this stuff, could be better, sometimes they're good enough. You know, you get to find out that ambient social ties that you wouldn't normally find out.
I mean, when a very good friend of mine from law school died very, way too young, not that long ago, and, you know, being the nerd that I am, when I went to her funeral, I took pictures, I asked her husband, who also was an old friend of mine, if I could record some of the eulogies. And because I knew it, actually had another friend die way too young, tragically, someone put up a web page, and that was the closest I got to getting to grieve. I couldn't make it to his funeral. And I wanted that feeling of being with other people who cared about him, and I wanted to remember him. And so I put up a Facebook group. And a lot of people who were looking for her with her old, you know, her maiden name, found it, and it was very important to her. Even years, sometimes a year later, that's how they found out that she had died, because it surely wasn't expected. We were pretty young for that to be happening. So I know initially it wasn't maybe the most comfortable thing. I wanted to check in, you know, with the family first and say every time, is this okay for you? Do you want this? But I know it meant a lot. It's also how I saw a lot of people from law school I hadn't talked to in a long time, because they're like, I called a couple of our professors to let them know I wanted them to spread the word. Because I also wanted her, I'd say widow, too young for him to be widow. I wanted to get as much support as possible. I wanted to hear from as many people as possible when we get in touch with them.
It's interesting to me that we're, you know, that's the sad stuff. I'm just thinking about how much has changed in 10 years as it relates to this. Because 10 years ago, when I was still a web designer, 11. Do you want me to stand up, Andrew? You can say so. My nephew, who's now 11, was born, and I'm the web chick in the family. And so I decide, how cool would it be to make a website for my nephew for his birth? Right? And I'm just bringing in the story to show how culturally we've all accepted these tools as something real. And I worked really hard to design this website. And I did all the usual things. Everyone else who was born on this day and everything you could, you know, all the things you can possibly imagine. We actually put it up, you know, a few days before he was born. So we had to guess how much he's going to weigh and people could throw up, you know, what they thought and all that stuff.
Yeah, Myers is saying whoever makes social work, the mortality space, it has to be tumbled and it will be big. But there's really no way to do it without human tumbling, especially around that. I think people would know that if you're going to just try to be like, autumn, like I want us to move into social ambient sociality quite soon. But I think, you know, when you're having a moment of resonance, you want to feel connected to people who aren't there, and we're only going to have more live streaming and more video. I think we're only going to see how important hosting is.
to really have, or tunneling to have a sense of, you know, am I paying really attention to what you need as a person? Can I see? Because in those instances, we're much more conscious of how important paying attention to other people's feelings are. We, in other places, aren't paying attention when we're creating some of these places, and we're just kind of, oh, whatever you do want, it's fine.
Right, and the point I was bringing up with the story was that, back then, you know, the present had to be something physical. Right. That trust me, after, you know, 2 weeks of hard work on this, it went nowhere and it was not appreciated for the work. It was, oh, nice, they created a website. Didn't mean anything because it was over there on the net. And everyone who brought the presents from the baby gap, it was really cool. So I'm bringing it up in the sense that culturally, in like 10 years, the concept of digitally participating and hosting online and celebrating moments that are happy and maybe ones that aren't so happy in a virtual space, for want of a better word, is a real thing that we can feel and touch. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, it was ether. It was really thought of as a lot more ether and not as permanent and not as persistent and not as real. So it's kind of interesting that we treat these spaces as very
real. We do. I think a lot of people still, especially certain ages, don't. But I think if...
But they're interwoven. They're part of the fabric of how we communicate and what we do, whether you define real or not. Even, you know... Something that I was talking to a friend of mine today at the conference who was talking to me about, he has a very big age gap with his kids. So he's got his oldest is in college and his baby's 4 years old. And his 4 year old is so dexterous online that he goes up and if his dad logs into his iTunes account and the kid gets to the screen away, he has to be really careful because he'll download like 10 apps quickly. Right? And he was saying to him, oh, you can't just keep downloading apps. They cost money. He goes, well, what do you mean? And it sort of made me realize that like kids, like we have a concept of the physical money used to be physical and now it's digital through credit cards. But what's the value of money, you know, if you never saw it as a physical thing? Like it's really hard to teach his kids the value of money when it's all ether. So the same thing, the website had no real true value 10 years ago. I didn't understand the complexity of what you could do there because it wasn't a physical thing. So it's just interesting to see that we're now kind of even talking about the fact that you could host a real space that means something real online, whereas 10 years ago we could.
And it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. It's happening already. It's just going to be, you know. Tron is coming out again. For all the geeks.
So I'm sorry, do you want to jump in? I'd like to take it back to Andy and Michelle, if you want to get into this thread.
It is it's kind of a, I'll make it brief, just that it's been kind of a whirlwind 12 or 18 hours, and that one this morning, just before I was about to go to sleep, I figured out, deciphering semi-cryptic Twitter posts that, someone that I've gotten to know really well electronically had died at the age of 31. Chris Al Aswan, who started Escape Into Life, an amazing community for artists and writers, who is creating a marketplace for artists to sell their work. We had just exchanged messages about a week ago, about 10 days ago, about collaborating in some way. And just sort of deciphering Twitter, I realized he's dead at the age of 31.
And his tweet or someone else?
Someone else's. Although he was still posting, auto-posting from Tumblr. But,
oh, that's
funny. Yeah. And in the last 12 hours, there has been an outpouring online, hashtag TYChris. Recognizing the impact that he had on people's lives, just as he was getting rolling with this wonderful website. I don't know what's happened, but and I'm still totally reeling from this. And at the same time, you know, and then a few hours later, I'm riding on the train up to Philadelphia, and I'm hanging out with you guys who I've met electronically. And suddenly, in the last 12 to 18 hours...
Your so-called virtual world doesn't feel so virtual.
Exactly.
Right.
Suddenly, very real, physical.
Yeah, I just... There was a guy also... I mean, I'm sorry about your loss. I'm just looking at the tweet stream. It's pretty intense. And, you know, it's a much smaller point, but one of the guys who was contributing in the room during our tumbling session, we were talking with him, made the connection. He's working for an LGBT organization here in Philadelphia. And then afterwards, I saw him tweet about it, and I realized, oh, I know you there, too. I didn't recognize your avatar so specifically, but we followed each other for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we do. We know each other more than we think we do. And it's just an amazing, the feeling changes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you, Andrew, have obviously, I've had a chance to talk, and you've typed for a long time. So, a long time online.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen you more consistently online than a lot of people every week during the show. And that's kind of part of the point of consistency, the ritual of that thing being consistent. It creates that sense of being able to connect because, you know, some people go to religious services, but most people, when we create a ritual, how we go to the gym, right? What are the things we do regularly? My hope of the Heather Gold Show, which I'm not going to keep the name, but it was to have this thing based on Shabbat where the show would be a regular sense of space for people to talk and about things that were meaningful to them, to have that kind of time together regularly. And it was that way live, and it's taking me a while to make it work online the same way. And getting closer to the point where I'll be able to do that again. And that, for me, is a really wonderful feeling when you're doing something that matters and where you feel like people notice. Like, if you're there or not, and you build a deeper sense of connection. In my sense, of from what most people appreciate about whatever I've done as a performer, yes, I can be funny, this or that, but that's usually the most valued thing. If there was a time that felt meaningful for them with other people they were with. So I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm sorry to every bit that there's an incredible number of people online. And I have to say, I really hope we don't have to. Could there be a way you could feel that you touch this many people without dying?
Good question.
This is a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. Now.
Yeah.
I think, not to be counter and flip about it, but I think you can feel while you're alive that you touched a lot of people. I think it just has extra resonance that we're feeling now after the fact. The question is whether he was able to feel that today.
Well, I'm saying part of what good tumbling could do in certain situations is to create that kind of feedback for someone so they feel like they're really listening to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, part of what you're doing is creating space, you're creating a sense of focus, that attention, and then saying, here, I'm going to put you in a spotlight for a bit. Feel this.
Mm-hmm.
Feel what comes out of this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what, from my experience, the kind of performance I do opens people up. That melts. We're all really listening to you. I'm going to let you know we really heard you. That's, from my experience, what helps people be more open. So that's part of the reason I talk about things like miscarriage. Yes, it benefits me for sure, but I'm hoping you'll be more likely to tell me. So I know I've touched on kind of been heavy stuff today, Ted. But you brought up that concept. Well, I don't know. It's just making it interesting. You talked about this concept of ambient sociality. I think we were saying we do think that the next level of what's going to be built in the web on top of, I know Twitter, I don't know how much building on top of a force of a Twitter other than, the new games is happening, but that there'll be an attempt to try to intelligently know some of what you need and want to create some social spaces. I know a few little things that are starting to try to create little bits of that. You want to say more about kind of what you're thinking about that, and maybe now that you've heard a little more about this tumbling idea, how even having people like as in a role that how you would build something, how can we build things that also make, you know, to be effective, could have someone in there helping make some of those decisions along with, okay, this is the best way we can work with the data, but what's the goal? Like you were saying, it'd be great when I had this moment, I'm sad to have a place to go to, that I didn't have to put out so much work to get everyone to show up there for me.
I actually come from a sensation that profile-based sociality and login and these things are actually going to really be a hallmark of Web 2.0. And whatever comes next those aren't going to be the hallmarks of that. I think it'll be something that's like always on. You are constantly logged into the internet, and everything you use and interact with has an intelligence with that. That could be the phone calls you make. That could be everything you do, the places you are, GPS, and that. So the ambient sociality, I don't see as being built upon collecting APIs of your social activity, but a whole next step of your presence is
you don't go to a place to be social. You're just always everything is socialized.
Yeah.
The way that we do that,
and
we don't go to a place.
You log into Facebook. Yes. You
offline. You don't.
Offline, you don't. Yes. So, and that I think is going to be more of the Holy Grail. You just are where you are is connected to the internet without having to use a service or a collection of disparate services. We're all competing for different financial goals. Some are just trying to justify their VC rounds. Some are trying to justify their $15 billion valuations. I think what we see succeeding now will be the eBays and Amazons of Web 1. But I've been spending a lot of time trying to figure out how this experience happens, with the extra benefit of things being pointed out to you, your friends two blocks away. Your friend had a sadness on Facebook. You might want to go look at that.
Right. I mean, I had a thought when I don't think it was on a past television show that someone had said, I was just saying, how does ambient sociality translate into long-term relationships?
Well, like ambient intimacy, like the rainbow.
Happens over and over again. Yeah, things, I mean, it's having these experiences, yeah, that makes you feel like you're safe and a little bit, you're connected. I mean, essentially, psychologically, what makes you feel like you exist is the social connection to other human beings. I was going to say, Ted, that I know I'm talking to Laura Fitt, and she has some really, at Pistachio, we had a really good show with her, some really strong thoughts about changing purchasing and what Amazon's doing and kind of, you know, environment of Twitter and where the web is now socially. And when somebody said on the show QEC, I think it was in the chat room, and it might have been Myers, that's usually asking great questions, how aren't we stuck with Google? Aren't we stuck with Apple? Is everything going to be in these kinds of, or Facebook in these worlds, and nothing can change? And I thought, you know, we thought Excite was really going to be important in Lycos. And so my sense of it is, because I really, to me, Facebook is so AOL, and I can never get over them feeling like AOL, but I can't believe they'll be around that long. And the thing that I think does compete, even with Apple today, around certain stuff, is social stuff. Like radio, RDIO, is in some ways, because it's making your experience of music social from the get-go and not about ownership, so it's not working with the same financial model as Apple, immediately has a way where you feel with your friends, which you don't get. Apple does nothing about it. It makes beautiful things and experiences, but it has absolutely no ability to make you feel like you're with people you care about. Truth be told, neither does Google. They suck at it. We talk about it every other show here. And the new way in which it shows up that Google is meant to do this. So because of that, in a weird way, the chipping away at these huge behemoths from a business landscape is through these social connections and through smaller players who are able to make social connections work well. And if you serve a social connection well enough, which obviously Facebook has not built as a center of what it's providing you, if you're a good enough environment in tumbling space, you could do that,
yeah,
Ted, in a much broader way. In the weird way, that would be the kind of opportunity in the landscape, because every time we get a new kind of layer of the web, you get to go at these basic businesses all over again.
Agreed.
There was PayPal, there was eBay, there's blah, blah, blah. But if they don't themselves stay flexible enough and stay centered around the things that you want, then someone else can be a place where you just go spend your time. And then how hard is it to sell the stuff in that space or what have you? So it seems to me that what we're talking about, I know we're kind of early, but that's the kind of thing you talk about at Supernova. I don't know if VCs are listening to our show yet. They should. So, you know,
if they know what's good for them.
Yeah, but you know, it's about people. I don't know how much they get that people are kind of where all the business comes from. I don't know how many business people get that, but it's true. Yeah, I've never seen eyeball make a business or buy anything, so I don't know. When I have that, that's just my sense. I can totally see that happening. Why not? why not? I think people think because they own so such and such membership or they have email lists or whatever that they kind of own that person to sell them stuff forever.
Yes. They're stuck in business models that they will not be able to change. You cannot, you know, eBay is such an awful job changing.
Yeah.
Right. Meg Whitman's running for governor. When things were great, she led things well. When things were bad, it went on for like 6 years of a company that had no innovation.
And no user experience. It's the worst user experience on the web, which is sad because they were one of the first to do anything reasonable business wise in the web. Yeah. I mean, shit, I don't want to do that in California.
And California's in a mess right now. It's not doing great, and she's going to lead greatness.
So we should have adapted past. No, they should just do a big consulting gig where they redesign.
Maybe the people taking over AOL now should take a crack at California.
Yeah, I think that the tension that we're talking about here is about the, you know, aggregated big business models versus, you know, I'm going to make a long thread, hyper local, right, versus distributed or hyper local or small.
Which is inconsistent, right? Like we have music sales, no, in Napster, and then that goes away, and then people try to re-put it back in one place, and then Apple says, no, it's all here. And then, because we're going to be better devices, at least, to make it be all here. And then places like radio and Pandora are not out there.
Right. And it's oddly in this media construct, this you know, we want big. Bigger is better. It's funny. Thinking about how your phraseology about ambient sociality is really interesting to me. Because a few years ago, Lisa Reinhart, I always forget to pronounce her last name, Reinhart, poorly spoke at a conference called Reboot, where she called it ambient intimacy. And what's interesting, in just the 3 or 4 years that we are now all in this social online world, just the phrase intimacy is coming at it with a construct of can we be intimate in ambient ways, right? So, and then they had New York Times articles about it, and Strength of Weak Ties, and Mark Renavitter, we've been talking about this for years. But what you're saying is, it's here. We are ambiently social all the time. How can we create tools or spaces or whatever to improve the quality of life instead of, you know, sort of shoving our behavior into binary tools online. So the construct of whether we do have strength of weak ties or bigger communities or all that, it's a given. It's here. My nephews will never be disconnected from their kindergarten friends.
Ever.
They will always be connected for them, for better or worse.
Never, barring a giant world war.
Right, exactly. So how do we create tools that enhance that experience is what you're saying, versus arguing whether it's good or bad.
And how do we as people learn to handle people who are different? Like, there are people from my book I didn't want to know anymore. It wasn't such a great experience for me. If people were virtually treating me the way they were literally treating me, that wouldn't have been so fun. And I know that's happening for kids. You can just choose to not talk to them anymore. I know people who have Facebook names that are intentionally different than their original names so that the people from high school can't find them. But at the same time, I had a guy from high school or junior high get in touch with me not long ago and start IMing me. And once I figured out who he was, I was like, oh, I remember you. You were a shithead to me. And he's like, really? And then I told him, so he apologized. Is it too late to apologize? I was like, no. I surely never thought I was going to get one. And then I let him know how it affected me, you know, how he behaved. And totally was, you know, interesting. But anyway, if you're going to deal with those situations, we don't just need tools. We need human skills and an effort towards dealing with difficult stuff, difficult feelings, conflict. How do you still staying connected to things where they're hard, which to me is exactly the emotional task of growing in our development as people. And this, to me, is at the center. The tools ideally should support this. If we just look for tools and not say what they're for, because I can build a tool, you're based on what assumptions is how you are as a person. You know, I mean, this is to me the essence of what we're trying to advocate for. And we need to grow as people too. We need to all learn better skills. I mean, we need to really push. I think the popularity of the personal growth sector, I mean, to me, every other business book is really a personal growth book in kind of language that makes it okay to handle. Let's face it, that's what we're all doing. It all comes down to you working on your own ability to handle stuff as a person.
And those of us who can afford to, you know, afford in the sense of have the time, intellectual space, and bandwidth to address these issues. There are many people on the planet who are still worried about, you know, food on the table and their jobs. So
I'm sure, but even if you're worried about food on the table in your job, you're dealing with the issues that let you put food on the table in your job, which is other people.
Yeah, I'm just saying they're not intellectually...
But they're emotionally having to learn how to deal. Whether you read a book about it or not, you need to find some way to handle it. Ideally, learn from another person.
I completely agree. This behavior is leading to less and less good human interpersonal skills and more fake personal skills. Oh, I thank you on Facebook. Did you see it? You don't even... you note is gone. You know, an email is lucky, a text message. Thank you. Merry Christmas!
Yeah, so...
And, you know, that's the norm that we're headed towards without a warm embrace of the importance of human... And I think it's only when people get left alone, when they're crying on Thanksgiving because they didn't make any plans and no one texted them, or they realize that, like, I just got text for Thanksgiving. Wow, it feels so hollow inside. What have I done with my life?
Seriously, I'll text you next Thanksgiving. I'm sorry. You know, this is a subject that's so near and dear to my heart that I think I just put it into our talk at Sapphire where I was like, Dear Miss Manners, WTF Social Web. And I think I'm going to talk about it at the 140 conference in a few weeks, which is basically speaking to a room full of people who have lost touch with the etiquette around being human and saying to them, you know, guys, what is being, what's just the right way to behave humanly? You know, it's not okay to ignore phone calls or respond to people or ignore email. Like, we live in this world where, and this is a pet peeve of mine specifically, and I'll give a very concrete example. If you have my cell phone number, we are already pretty intimately connected. You do not need to go through social network A, B, C, or D to connect with me. What it says if you connect with me through Facebook or Twitter DM or anything else is that your time is more important than mine. Why?
Well, to you, I know people who are angry if I call them. They want it to DM.
Agreed, but listen to why. Because what it's saying is, and I had to find out which friends it were, and that's the part of my story that I'm getting to, is that we don't know what communication device people prefer. But my point is that what it says to me is if you are on Facebook at this moment in time, you're using the tool that works best for you at that moment in time to connect with me. It is not taking a second back and saying, wow, does this person prefer this method, that method? What's the best way to actually connect with them? It's like showing up 15 minutes late says that my time is more important.
So, Ted, in the context of these needs, these human needs, how can ambient sociality serve them? I mean, because building a new mousetrap only is useful if it's serving some real need. And this is a real need for us to have real meaningful connection, feel like we're matter in each other's lives, feel like we're giving each other short shrift?
Well, let's see. Maybe being able to listen to your friends better. So if you're not following a post that they made at 11:50 p.m. Mm-hmm. or you're on a plane, you would hear that that their dog is sick right now. That's pretty sophisticated, but could happen. You could be told that your friend's friend is considering the same decision right now about which version of this medical procedure to get, or this happened to them last month. And if you'd like to ask them, you could send that person an email right now. So this isn't hugging someone, but you've just upgraded from following a friend of a friend's Twitter stream to emailing that person, being able to email with them, which is a much more intimate connection.
I like your point about the time distance, the time differentiator, though, like that I want to be able to find out the things that are important and going on in my friend's life, not just because I happen to be staring at the screen at the same time that they say. That's how it would improve our lives. So push to me, I hate that term, but push to me or bring to me the things that are relevant or important to me when I log back into the web or when I connect again or if I'm
always
on. That's the business. Start it now. I'm starting a business where you pay me $50 a month to take you off the web. I'm going to pay me, I'll take you off the grid.
I mean, there's freedom. People already have an app for that, or, you know, old school, they could just turn the router off.
There's some writers doing 6 months with no web. I'm like, oh, yeah, that'd be really neat. couldn't go a day. I know I can go a day, but realize I would be shaky after a week. And it's just, and I kind of pride myself on being, you know, I'm independent. Nothing's got its control on me.
Well, but the thing is we...
But it's going to be with us forever, so yeah. It's not like
it, these are just human... I mean, if it wasn't the web, it would be smoking, it would be drinking, it would be shopping, it would be... I mean, bottom line is, it would be anything you want to do, having drama with your girlfriend, whatever it is, you can find a way to distract yourself from yourself, and that's why I think everything comes down to personal growth, just kind of yourself. I mean, Dina Free is saying, I think, incredibly insightfully... We gave a little mm-hmm. time a couple weeks ago. Have you ever seen Century of the Self?
No.
It's a really great video series.
Cool.
On BBC. It's free on Google Video. Incredible. Based on the work of Edward Bernays, the guy who invented PR, who was a relative of Sigmund Freud. And it's a lot about manipulation of public communication and other people. And we tried to go forward. Anyway, based on that, she said, oh, isn't this related to Century of the Self and how you've been pushed to view others in terms of what we can get from them? And having to protect ourselves from what they want from us. People have become objects, consumers. Yeah, we had business become not just, I need a hat, I go to a hat maker. Hi, person. I mean, I'm not, we always had, you know, snake oil salesman, but what can I get out of you? You're a thing and get something out of. How can I, of course, in a relational realm, once I've treated you that way, why would you want to have any ongoing connection with me if I've come to perceive that? So
but once we scaled it to this large, big industrial companies, it also made it much more of that. But so if you went to the local snake oil salesman and you treated him poorly, you didn't go back then.
If you were able to perceive you were treated poorly, if you perceive that as the norm, you may not even see it. It takes mm-hmm. sometimes pain. And in Dina Freeney and Myers, if she's saying hopefully it's been a change and Myers is feeling more cynical, I believe that, you know, pain is really the motivator, most often the most reliable one. And people bottom out, I think, Ted. I'm not saying everyone, but I think because the pace of stuff is moving faster, I think bottoming out will happen faster for more people. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying for everyone, because some people will stay in their experience of the world as it is, as long as it works for them. But often...
Define bottoming out?
When you hit a point where you literally can no longer function the way you've been functioning, it can be, I mean, I just did, you know, in the law project, I tell a story of, you know, why I ended up going to law school, a lot of stuff about the law, and then this accident I had 4 years ago, which was quite life-changing for me, and I ended up very much a reluctant plaintiff after years of telling everybody that suing was the worst thing you could do as a person. But I ended up in somatic therapy, and I ended up in this accident, finding out I had PTSD, and I learned a tremendous amount about the body and trauma and what it is to live in your head and what it is to live in your body, how that return is made, how it functions, what it means to do small amounts of things, what it means to be present. And I think if you're going to be with other people, that's really what Livingstone's work is all about, is becoming, trying to be present in your body. You have to make those decisions yourself. No one else can really make them for you.
Well, it starts in your own body. I mean, what Ted was talking about, that people are being sort of rude today, right?
Right.
Or this whole new level of potential rudeness is if you don't start with what Linda talked about, being conscious yourself, then you can't see another person. You know, you're always living in that.
Right. You're looking to the other person to reflect your needs. But ironically, part of the reason tumbling is effective when you do it is you're basically emotionally containing other people. And when you do that, by that I mean, if you can't tolerate your feelings, I'm going to let you know those feelings are okay with me and I can handle expressing them and whatever's happening. When you do that, people inherently relax. Because once you let yourself have a feeling, you're being present and your whole nervous system shifts. And then they'll express differently. And I find as an audience, their energy shifts and helps shift everything in the room. I just have done it enough times in enough shows to know it's a pretty consistent thing. I've never met anyone who didn't like a kind of mirroring act of really letting them know that you've heard them.
What's interesting about what bottoming out happening quicker is a silver lining to work against the Zeno and Myers quasi-cynicism in our chat room tonight, is that perhaps a lot of this sort of sense of anomie that people have of feeling isolated and alone, which had happened, which you could argue was an impetus for people getting on the web and the internet to connect. If they're not getting that wholeness on the web or through connectedness online, and there is a quicker bottoming out, then hopefully it'll also be a quicker uptick. I mean, you would hope that we would be able to catch that we're feeling more isolated and more alone, and then maybe that is supposed to do that. Because I do kind of sense that people are walking around, you know, too much stuff coming at you, too quickly, too fast, this isn't working for me. Whereas in the past, that might have taken years to identify. So I'm sort of trying to see if the magnification of this happening quicker and more real time can actually, we can catch it and turn it around. Because I do sense that on this grand scale, a lot of people are really frustrated that everything feels very slow these days.
But not 16-year-olds who are texting each other all day long and are really mad when someone doesn't text them back in under a minute.
Yeah. But that's because they want to be acknowledged. The same thing. We want to feel like someone was giving
us feedback. What you did at 16. Yeah. We did it in different ways. We screened at each other.
Computers give consistent feedback. It is a program. It's one of the reasons people like to rely on them. We rely on them more than people because they don't feel the person will be reliable and see them. That's what a lot of this behavior, I think, behavior on YouTube is. Someone listened to me, maybe. People are like, oh, it's so narcissistic. I think they're often looking to feel seen. The more seen you see, hopefully eventually, if you get to feel that, then you stop being so narcissistic because you don't need other people to reflect yourself to you all the time. You can learn, once if you get a taste of it through other people, you can hopefully learn to internalize that stuff. I mean, I know for me, that's what I've gone through in the last number of years, and it's radically changed the quality of my life, and so that I can sometimes make a choice then to go offline for a few hours, as opposed to I can't tolerate the feeling of aloneness because I right now live in Long Island. I don't have a lot of a real life social connection there. I usually have to travel to have it. Based on I'm in a place where just not that super simpatico with kind of who I am. It's been easy to meet people, and so I needed, you know, to be online for a long time just to feel like I wasn't completely alone. But you know, it's been an incredible bonus because now, I mean, I've done a lot of work to do it. I mean, I meditate twice a day. I do a lot, but I wouldn't have got there if I didn't need to. I wanted to work on a show where I needed to be able to handle certain feelings because I couldn't write the piece until I'd felt it. I mean, you can't make stuff when it's overwhelming. And I mean, it's helped me. I mean, all this tumbling stuff has helped me a tremendous amount, be able to handle whatever's going to come up in the room. I had somebody last night completely, like, you know, march into the theater in the middle of my show and stretch out her arms and say to everybody, here I am, I'm here now. And the audience was like, WTF. So I'm just a chick. Yeah. And I totally handled it. Well, it's just the idea that I can deal with this. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to put her at ease because they beauties. If I reamed her, I'd lose the rest of them.
Right.
But that meant I had to, like, not need them to be there for me. If I needed that, I wouldn't be. I mean, that's part of engaging an audience as a speaker performer.
Right.
And it's true of the business. If you need them to do something for you, you're not providing them something. They're there for you.
Mm-hmm. To Ted's point around the 16-year-olds, the fear is, though, that we're raising multiple generations, parents and now teenagers, who need so much constant love me, love me, love me, need me, you know, give me, give me, give me, that how are we going to break that cycle? I
couldn't disagree more.
And
I think we were parented by people who are that way. I don't see that as a new thing. I see that as old as the hills.
It's as old as the hills, but now that we have, but you know, different tools. Like they can, you know, you can get all this attention, and then Thanksgiving rolls around, and you realize, oh wow, I'm this wasn't actually as real as I thought it was.
But you built up the Thanksgiving before, and you built up to Christmas or whatever your holiday is.
And have a physical face to face with your intimate. You know, if you only have ambience.
Yeah.
The thing about the ambient intimacy phraseology, if you only have ambient, then you don't have intimacy. And if you only have intimacy, you might miss out on incredible serendipity. So, and the web provides the opportunity for broader experiences and more serendipity and more people. But it's sort of like this is an overly simplistic analogy, but there was a time, pre-industrial revolution, where, you know, work was sunrise to sunset, right? And then work became, and it was externally driven, right? So the sun went up and the sun went down, and that was the only time we could work. And then we moved to 9 to 5, still externally driven, some industrial whatever, 9 to 5. And then
after legislation that prohibited people from working more than 8 hours and not being sued over, which plenty of conservatives still wish was not the law,
okay,
and think it's not constitutional, then we moved to 9 to 5.
Okay, that wasn't my point in this particular.
Not only brought to you by liberal ideology, they got shoved at me.
Yes, okay.
Canadian. So then,
I read that in American Law.
I'm sure. So then, my point is that these were all external things that forced off time, quote unquote, family time, personal time. And then the last 20 years, how often do we have the conversation of BlackBerry on work is all the time? And the only way you're going to be successful, and you know, Heather uses these the language of container, is if we can work 24/7. We can be online 24/7. You need to have enough sense of self to realize that you have to create that framework and that control of either getting offline or meeting people in the real world or whatever it is. And it's a learned thing to do. Unless you're a neurosurgeon, you probably don't really have to be online all the time. Unless you're a news-breaking journalist, it's really important to remember, wow, I can get offline. It's fine for me. The question also is, I think there's a big difference between disconnecting and going out on vacations. You can probably do that really well. Like, if I'm away on vacation because I'm changed, the hard part is doing it in your daily life, right? You know, in your everyday life. Find the space and we're all that, you know, to find that space. And I find that the more that I do that, the more important the better thinking that I do, it's like filling up the tank.
It is. You know? But it's also knowing that you are making decisions. Because even if you aren't aligned, I mean, I grew up reading a book and so
same thing.
You can check out doing a lot of stuff.
That's the point. Not having things come at you. And we talked about this. I don't remember if it was with Sarah Dopp or someone else. Oh, I talked to Sarah before she was even on the show. Some people do, and that's why I don't love these apps. They do 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off, you get on. I actually can't switch gears that quickly. I actually I can't even do a morning online or offline. I do entire days. Because if you really think about it, to ramp up and get into that thinking space, the reflection space, whether I'm talking mostly in work mode now, but it applies across all because work and life and how slowed down you feel aren't separate for me. I do it for an entire day because it's like a writer who sits down to write and they do it for a few hours. By the time you get into that meditative, slower, thinking, relaxing space, you know, it takes a while, and then it takes a while to pull yourself out. I do entire days.
I think there's lots of ways to do it.
Yeah, is you? That's just the way I do it.
Well, I just think one metaphor that I've heard for writing is it's sort of like going into a deep sea dive when you're a scuba diver, and you have to, like, prep at each depth to get adjusted to the pressure. And finally you get down to the point where you want to be, and then you can't come up too fast either. So it takes time. Or like an old steam engine. You gotta stoke it, get it hot enough, and then it gets going.
I always read before I go to bed, and I bought some books on the iPad. And now it's a different experience because I could just finish reading that paragraph, or I could check email.
Right.
I could finish that, or I could go. And it's not.
But it's also if you make it a habit, a ritualistic for yourself that you do a certain thing each time, which is frankly what you do for infants. That's how they learn to have consistency. It starts to feel a rhythm where it would feel weird to check email if you make yourself only read for 20 minutes.
If I'm in a device that has an internet connection, it's going to get checked.
No, I don't know. I would like
try not to.
I don't know. I managed to change it. And I think the only reason is because I got to a point where I realized, first of all, so I talk about it in the show and I'll probably start blogging about it soon.
So maybe it's possible.
I learned after this accident experience, I had a certain amount of trauma that some people call PTSD. And part of the first thing I learned in somatic therapy, the first thing was that I was dissociating, which I think many people are doing it different ways. They just might not call it that. Linda's calling it email ask me or whatever it is. You're saying I have to make this an extraction. And once you learn that you are and you learn to notice that you are and then you learn how to come back from it, the qualitative feeling of how you just feel is so much better. You don't realize that you're going that place because you feel kind of anxious. Once you're able to get that to go away, you just feel better. You don't really want to. It makes it more of you have the impulse to go off as opposed to I have to make myself. I think once you're in a mind frame of I have to make myself do this, it's very hard to fight that. I don't think it works. That's why I mean about the bottoming out. You have to really, I think, get to a point where you learn that it feels good and then you're following the impulse to feel better. It's a very different kind of motivation than I've got to make myself away from this bad thing. That's why I'm not just a fan of just pure behavioral adaptation of stuff because
you have to work together. But you know, you've given me at least a whole new idea for our tumbling shows. We should do weekly intervention.
Oh, I like that.
We should
that.
Have a guest on every week who wants help. You know, 10 minutes of Heather, Kevin, and Deb's weekly intervention tips.
We're going to be back next week.
Okay. Right.
Extreme mind makeover.
Extreme mind makeover. Right, exactly.
So Ted, we only have 4 more minutes, but seriously, let's do another show with you. Say next week. Are we okay next week?
No, we're having we have someone on next week. Really? We're on soon.
I think we have an opening.
We have an opening.
We'll have you back to talk more about if you really feel like you have to connect. What you're doing before you get to sleep, why, and also maybe some time where you emotionally want a real connection with people in your own life, because you're going to keep thinking about ideas around it, be it sociality, where it would be good for you, when you want, if we're going to try to build something, so.
She's better at that, by the way. I'm in the middle process of doing this. Like, I have to very consciously say, why are you getting, you know, why are you inputting, like, why are you jumping in here now? Is it a need, an internal need, an external, like, where is it coming from? And if we don't do that, we're all going to just bottom out and go, like, blow up. I had this vision of my brain blowing up one day, you know, steam pouring out, too much stuff, not enough engine power, you know, I'm going to blow a circuit, you know, we got to
I'm just really, really grateful that anything that's changed for me has been because I tried everything else I could think of that was not working. It's not because I was so, like, super, you know, insightful or brave. I just, I worked fast enough at failing at things. And then I eventually tried something else. And sometimes I got lucky and someone showed up in my life. I mean, I just know, like, I don't have depression anymore. I'm saying perfect, but my life is a million times.
You're still evolved, Heather.
No, I mean, I'm just so much less shitty than I was. It's just, you know, it sucks. It really sucks. And it was, in a weird way, the first step for it to make it better is to feel how much it sucks. See, I think if you're kind of conscious that I have to do this, that's part of what starts. Because you're like, oh, I'm not, like, in charge of myself anymore. That's not a fun feeling.
Right.
I fucking have to log on. When you feel that, that's the beginning of maybe something's going to change. That's what I mean by the speeding up of the bottoming out. And also, when you see this many white dudes in the business world reading books with charts and graphs in them about emotions and you know, people thanking each other on the internet and stuff, and you see these kind of social races, you're seeing a slow, feminizing, emotional, slow learning of, I think we're at the beginning of a radical cultural change.
Yeah, there's a lot of articles. We'll bring them in another week, but I've been collecting all these articles on sort of social intelligence in our cultural world these days. Like getting tuned into this.
Because the truth is, you can mentally read about social and emotional stuff, but at the end of the day, you have to experience it.
Yeah.
It's very frightening to experience if you haven't been dealing with your emotions. There's no way around it. It's a kind of personal emotional growth. You can learn it and how it operates and all the stuff we talk about the show. It's fun. But when you want to build it yourself eventually, your mind can't support your feelings. You have to learn to handle your feelings, not just with your mind. The mind is the reason you can't handle your feelings. It's where you run to avoid your feelings. And something the mind's always bad. It's just they can't do everything. I'd say someone who worships mind as much as anybody. So that's just kind of my top of my thoughts. And that's what I was talking about all last night.
I finally got our photo up in there.
Yeah, everyone drank.
Yeah, we usually do drink during the show.
I need a drink after this one.
Deb, can you tweet that one out, too?
I'm having a lot of trouble with bands. I'll do it right after the show.
So we're going to need to wrap up. First of all, I wish we'd opened the show this way, but I want to take special time out. If you can speak, Mike, I hope you can. I want to thank, congratulate Mike Vardy, Engineer Mike.
I'm here.
Everyone at home, drinks for Mike's dad.
So welcome to Colton, to the world.
Colton, we're tumbling you into our community.
Yeah, the thing is, kids are pretty perfect when they're born, and also,
don't fuck them up, Mike.
They're super emotional before they can do anything else. They're really good with emotion, which is always my answer to everybody who tells me I'm just born this way, or I'm just, you know, I'm just wired this way. It's very analytic. I say to you, bullshit, you were 1 week old once. And there was nothing analytic happening. So So thanks, Colton, and thanks, Mike Vardy, and Ted Reingold, Mr. Dogstercaster.
My pleasure.
During this awesome ambient sociality chat. Please come back and help grow our fun little safe, intimate
good
tunnel vision
good
space.
Yeah, I'm glad I understand tunneling now. It's very important, and it's becoming a lost art. I watched the movies from the 40s and the 50s, and the fabulous Hostess says, oh, Mike, you must meet James.
Yeah.
We both are novelists. And then they walk away because they're going to do that to everyone else, and they're not actually going to talk to any of their guests because that would actually be rude. A lot of hosts get that backwards.
Yeah.
But if you can succinctly introduce two people and give them something to talk about for the next hour, boom, go, too. That's, I like this on a much more day-to-day level, not just because you're hosting, but because...
Yeah, it helps. It's nice. So hopefully it'll come back. We'll do my makeover. Andrew Hazlett, thank you for your engineering support and your help.
It's great to not be a brain and a vat myself, you know, to actually
look at
see you guys and hang out a bit. It's awesome. So thank you.
And Myers and Xenophrenia, you guys get big points because it was a quiet little room tonight, huh? I know we couldn't say ahead of time who was going to be with us. We just knew it would be good.
We were all traveling and showing.
The Osmi. Oh yeah, they just saw the picture.
Babies are so cute.
Someone quick put up a picture of a puppy or a cat.
Does it mean that he's gonna be on Baby Stir?
I have the domain. I don't wanna do it.
Yeah. Too complicated.
Yeah.
I'd much rather brag about my dog than my daughter. Although I'd be happy to brag about my daughter.
Myers and Xenophrenia, I just want to let you know, I too, like both of you, when life was hard as a kid, went to the library. That was also the place to go.
Yes. I was the daughter of a librarian.
But I want to say I'm hoping that we can help make a world where, yes, to libraries, there are places where there'll be people also who will be nice. Woo-hoo! Make a point of it. So anyway, it's been a great show. We'll be back next week with, is it Bryn?
Bryn, yeah, social interaction design superstar.
So Bryn Evans?
Yeah.
At Bryn, BRYNNN, NN, two N.
NNN.
So we're here at Supernova. If you want to check it out, supernovahub.com, SN10, hashtag ensemble. And we'll be back next week with another wonderful edition of Tunnel Vision TV. It's we look forward to seeing you soon. And if there are other things you want to dig into around ambient sociality, let us know at the site, tunnelvision.tv. Thanks, Engineer Mike and Colton. We'll see y'all next week.